accession number 16059, John Court, reel 2.
Mr. Court, reel 2. You're saying that because you'd been accustomed to discipline at home, you were happy to accept it in the army.
Yes, I think so.
Did that apply to the other recruits in your squad as well?
No. Several, I mean, I think a lot of them, I mean, again, because I was a young lad with no sort of ties at home, it wasn't so bad for me, but I can remember many of the men in the room actually crying, married men, because they were away from their families, and a lot of them found it very, very hard to accept the fact that they were there, and the fact was that because they were much older, I feel that with their families, they just couldn't sort of get used to the idea that they were going to be away for a period of time. Some acted the fool, I believe, some one or two of them. We had one or two so-called wide boys who would march with both arms walking together and deliberately, you know. And we found out one or two of them had actually been through the previous squads and were put back and were in this squad. This was obviously a ploy to remain at the training school. I don't know how many times they went through the basic training, but I suppose they were working on the basis if they were, you know, sort of acted foolish enough, they might get thrown out. I don't know. But no, we had one or two quite wide boys. But
how did the NCOs cope with them? Do you remember what they did to deal with them?
Well, Mason, Sergeant Mason, he was very good, actually. He tolerated them. I think he had the ability to make them look foolish. That they became embarrassed, I'm sure of that. He was very good, excellent NCO. He never pushed us too much. From what I can gather, he turned out some very good squads. You know, he was good.
Was he looking after you all the way through?
Yes, right the way through our basic training. Yes, yes. You know, obviously a regular.
Do you happen to remember what regiment he was from?
No, I don't. I can't remember that.
You seem to be saying that what distinguished a good NCO from a bad one was that the good NCO would actually have a degree of professional knowledge.
That's right. Yes, yes. And know when and what to ask of the men and not to expect too much from them from the beginning. He sort of led us in very gently. And in one respect, I sort of found him... Now, we had an RSM who was a terror. From what I can remember, also, I should mention he was ex-guardsman because he had his peak right down in front of his... And I think everyone used to sort of shudder when he came around. And he acted actually a buffer between us and the RSM, I'm sure.
Was there a great deal of emphasis on spit and polish and turnout?
Oh, yes, so much. Yes, our rooms had to be bumpered. This is the only thing which I used to feel was an absolute waste of time. But looking back on it now, I feel that, again, this is a sense of discipline again. You would go out in the field, perhaps with the tanks, you'd come in with your hobnailed boots, and the floors were bumpered with polish, and you had a big bumper which two of you used to have to go up and down until you could see your face in it. When it got too bad, and the floor was, although it was a wooden floor, it was almost black, you then had to scrape it and scrape all the old mud and polish off until it became clean again. To my way of thinking, that was unnecessary. You had one pair of polished boots, you had one pair of dubbin boots. all your equipment, your mess tins, your overcoat had to be folded back, so you had all your buttons hanging down the front, which had to be highly polished. You also had the belt round the front with the buttons showing, and they had to be absolutely spot on, equidistance. The two palliasses were put at the end, and then your three blankets with the two in the centre and one wrapped round it, and then all your boots, your palliasses, your housewife all had to be laid out in the front of those, and then you had an inspection every morning.
Who did that? Was that your sergeant, or was it the RSM?
RSM, and sometimes an officer would come round. That again, I didn't mind the laying out of the equipment. I used to look at the equipment and think, "Oh, that looks quite smart. The rooms look quite smart." What I did find is rather a silly thing to think of, but what I used to find hard was at night time they used to put wooden shutters up on the windows, and I would say 90% of the men smoked quite heavily, and when I went into the room, because not being a smoker myself, you could cut the air, you know, and I used to find that so difficult, you know, I could feel my throat aching with the tasting of the, you know, tobacco smoke. But I say in those days everybody smoked, so I was in the minority. But and our battle dresses were impregnated with a powder, none of the battle dresses were the same. Some were quite, some were of a greeny sort of very thickish material. Others were a lighter brown and not quite so badly impregnated. But it was my bad luck to get one of these thick, because at that time they were buttoned right up to the neck. And I know I just about finished my initial training, and there were some exercises going on Salisbury Plain. And after 6 weeks, you're allowed home for a weekend leave. And I came home on this weekend leave, and I got this terrific rash around my throat and neck. And I went to our local doctor, and I think he said it was impetigo. Anyway, he gave me some cream to put on it. And over the weekend, it seemed to get much worse, and it was spreading up the side of my face and around my chin. And I came back to Tidworth for an inspection, as we always had to have after a leave. And I remember standing there, and I just keeled over. And they took me into Tidworth Hospital, the military hospital at Tidworth. And I was in there for, I should think about a fortnight. We used to have these, some were much worse than myself. Some had it all over their heads, and the nurses used to scrub them until they started to bleed. And then, but I remember having gauze all over my face with a little hole for my mouth and two holes for my eyes. And they used to put this sort of calamine lotion on, and this, was it Genta Blue they used to put Gentian Blue. Mm-hmm. I remember that smothered all over us. Everybody in the ward was in the same situation. But again, maybe, I don't know, maybe the good Lord looked after me, because that particular time I remember looking out of the, it was a big to-do, and evidently the unit or several units had been out on a special exercise out on Salisbury Plain, and these units taking part in the exercise, the planes came over and they had to machine gun an area, and somebody boobed somewhere, and they shot up an awful lot of our own people. And I can remember looking out of the hospital window and seeing all these gun carriages go past with all the coffins on them. And so there again, maybe, I don't know, perhaps I would never have been on the exercise, but I don't know. But I know a lot of our boys were.
So the uniform made you ill. I mean, did you make a full recovery from that?
Oh, yes, I recovered from that completely.
What had gone wrong? What had given you this
No,
rash?
Evidently, this powder which they used to put in, some used to say it was anti-gas powder, others said it was just a powder to keep away lice and what have you. But the uniforms, when you picked them up in the quartermaster stores, used to be absolutely stiff. And we used to take them out on the veranda at Tidworth, because it's old, the iron veranda. And we used to beat them with our boots or anything to get the powder out, as much of the powder out as you could, you know. But you could never get it all out. It was just a case of it used to wear out over a period of time, you know. And if you sweated, as we often used to, then, of course, you got it round your, where it was tight round your throat. But, no, an awful lot of people had this. And I suppose it was just one of those... hazards.
Did it result in you being back squatted because you were off sick for a fortnight?
Oh, no.
Just
no.
Carried on?
Oh, just, no, it made no difference at all, really. Mm. No, I was up with the rest of them. In fact, we all, after the initial training, I think particularly at that time, we were having bad results in North Africa. So we were sent straight down to Bovington, and although... I had trained as a drive mechanic. They gave me a gunnery course down there, and I was down there for about, I suppose I was down there for about 6 weeks. Mm. And then there was sudden panic. I believe we were getting really, you know, bad results in North Africa. So they said we were, well, you know, the rumours go around, and they said we were going straight out to up to Liverpool, which we did. They took us up to Liverpool, to Seaforth Barracks at Liverpool. And that was one of the things, a little thing which showed me the efficiency of the British Army, was the fact that we used to be issued with pistols, and it was the what they used to call the old S series pistol, which was a horrible thing, which was obviously mass produced for tank regiments. It was like a black bakelite handle. And the metallic work was very, very crude indeed. But there were a few Webleys about with the wooden, worn-up butt handle. And I don't know how, I can't remember how, but I acquired one of these, and I was quite proud of it, because the finish, the metallic finish on the actual, on the barrel, on the rifling, it was superb. It was a very good pistol. But anyway, when we got to Seaforth Barracks, we'd been up there about a week, and they said there was a sudden panic in the middle of the night, and they said, right, we're moving out. So they took us down from the barracks to the docks, and they started to go, we all started to go on board the boats. We were all lined up on the dockside, and we were going forward bit by bit, and eventually we almost got to the ship, and they suddenly said, that's it, no more. So they loaded us back onto the three tanners and took us back to the Seaforth Barracks. And as far as we knew, that convoy sailed. Well, we were doing a guard at Seaforth Barracks, and but we had to hand all our... Well, there were several shootings, actually, in Liverpool, and so they decided to take all our pistols off us, and we had to put them in the guard room with our names on. So we handed all our pistols in, and... when it eventually came that they said, we're moving out, again, it always seemed to be in the middle of the night, we had a parade, and we were told to go to the guard room, pick up our pistols, and parade. Well, I went into the guard room, and all the pistols were hanging up on racks. And I went along, I couldn't find my pistol. I thought, well, it's got to be here. Couldn't find it, and of course they were yelling to get out on parade, so eventually I got out on parade, and they came along, checking, and I had, of course, I had to report that I had no pistol. And there's a lot of inquiry going on, you know, and they said, well, you know, and I said, well, I know I handed it in, and luckily, by sheer luck, an officer came forward, and he said, yes, I used the pistol on a guard mounting, so I know it was there, but it had missed. And so at least I breathed a sigh of relief. They knew at least I'd handed it in. Well, they put us on board a train, and they took us up to Scotland, and put us on this little boat, and took us out into the... trying to think of the name of the place up there, where all the big ships went from.
Greenock, would it be?
Greenock. And I know we went into the side of the boat, and they took us down to these cabins, and we were told to stay there. And I remember going down this very, very long corridor and into a cabin. We were told to stop there, and we were there for quite a few hours. And eventually, there was a terrific amount of rumbling, and we said, "Oh, we're off, you see." Instead of which, it was the doors were sliding across the corridors, and it broke the corridors up into 30 or 40 feet lengths with so many, obviously, in the event of a collision, I suppose, that they could shut off sections of the ship. So instead of being able to walk by the way along, we had to go up or up the stairs to the different decks. And even then I didn't realise that we were on board the Queen Elizabeth. And that was her first trip out with British troops on. Prior to that, she'd just carried American troops. And we had the advantage then of having all the American Pepsi Colas and chocolate and everything else, which was marvellous. And that was a wonderful...
Did you get your pistol back in the end?
No, I didn't. But anyway, we travelled on the Queen Elizabeth out, and that was a fantastic. We had two destroyers with us when we first left, and they stayed with us for about 2 or 3 days, and then they turned back, and we were on our own. And it was a fantastic ship. At times, we had a couple of sub scares, and when she picked up speed, you could stand on the back of the ship and look out, and you could see the zigzag, and it looked as though it was going for miles, you know, and the whole ship used to shake. A terrific feeling of power. It was a wonderful sensation. And we had a gunnery practice. They had a 6-inch gun mounted on the back, and I heard that they had 84 guns in all on board. They had the Horlickans and the Bofors, and that again was the firepower was terrific. You know, a complete blanket of over the whole of the ship the whole ship could be covered. It was a fantastic sight.
So did you do practice on the 6-inch gun?
No. We the only time I had any use for as a fatigue was we went to Simonstown and Freetown, and we loaded up fruit at Simonstown, and so we helped to load the fruit in the side of the ship and put it, and they took it up to the kitchens. That again, you know, I had never having been on a ship that size before. It was fantastic. That I mean, when we arrived out at Port Tewfik, we were the last troops to be left on board. And I walked around, and there were sections of the ship then. I mean, we were on her for just over 4 weeks. And there were sections of the ship that I hadn't found before. It was marvellous. And they were busily putting up barbed wire and barricades on the ship because they were taking prisoners back from the North Africa campaign. And I understand she was going back to Canada.
How much warning did you have that you were going to be sent out to?
Virtually none at all. None at all.
Just had orders to move.
Yes.
Did you go out as part of a large draft or?
Yes, because I understand there was 18,000 men on board the Elizabeth when she sailed. Mm. I think it was the build-up before. I mean, obviously, they had some idea there. I mean, they had made a stand at Alamein by then, and I think it was rushing us out there to ensure that. The Germans got no further than Alamein, just in case he was going to make another push.
Did you know you were going to Egypt when you had
No. We were issued with the pith helmets and tropical kit, but no, there was rumours flying around we were going to the Far East, and basically, I don't think it wasn't until we turned up into the Red Sea that we realised that we were going to, and then of course the ship's crew. Gave us a little more information as to where we were, and then we arrived at Port Tewfik.
How were you kept occupied on the voyage? What did you do with yourselves for that 4 weeks?
Well, strange. Not a lot. I mean, basically, Well, I suppose because we were not used to the heat, and she wasn't equipped really for going into the tropics, and they had iced water down the corridors, which a lot of fellows were rather stupidly drank iced water, and they had a lot of, in fact, they had one or two deaths through people drinking iced water when their bodies, you know, just couldn't take that. But you would go, you would stand, you could actually stand in your cabin, and the water would just run off you. I mean, there was very little fresh water. We had to wash in salt water.
What was the food like?
Excellent. Mm. Or the food was out of this world. Basically, I believe, because, again, I think she must have well stocked up when she left America, because, you know, the food was first class. We used to have three sittings. I think there was, on our mess alone, I think it was over 2,000 men sitting down, you know, and then they had three sittings, and then, of course, there were other messes throughout the boat. It was very interesting.
I'd like to go back, you know, to the beginning again. We described the basic training, and you said something about being trained as a driver.
Yes.
And trained as a gunner.
Yes.
And you did the driving training first, didn't you?
That's right, yes.
And was that done at Tidworth?
That was done at Tidworth, yes. Yes.
How long did it take you to learn how to drive a tank?
Well, not very long. Couple of 3 weeks, I suppose. Mm. It's first of all, in our basic training, we were taken out on old lorries. I was taken out on an old six-wheeled lorry, a real old wreck. And your ability to drive, I mean, you used to go out with 15 hundredweight trucks and three tonners and this old six-wheeler. We were going all around Tidworth, up and down Dale. And I suppose they assessed you from the ability to be able to handle the wheeled vehicle before you went on to track vehicles.
Were you able to drive before you joined the army?
No,
So you're taught from scratch.
That's right, yes. Yeah. And but I found, and of course it was all doubly clutching because, you know, they were all crash boxes. But I never... The only thing that annoyed me, and I suppose and that was the fact that I had been training on Valentines and Matildas, which are all diesel, and they decided to take me out, this officer decided to take me out of this A9, which was a petrol job. And some of the peaks down at Tidworth were quite sharp. And I used to pride myself on the ability, even especially with Shermans, the fact that I used to feel the tank, if one can say you can feel a tank under you, to your point of balance. And although I was looking at the sky, I'd sense where the tank was. And I always like to think that I gave my crew a good drive, because the moment you hit the peak and you feel the front coming down, you haul back on the sticks, shut off the power, and ease over, and then open up again the moment you come down the other side. Some of the drivers could never seem to do that. They would come up, and they'd still come up over, and you'd come off the other side, and you'd come down like a ton of bricks. I don't know why they could never feel it, but it wasn't to be with the A9. I was going out on this. I had to pass my test, and I remember going out, and I remember the officer, first of all, they had this big compass with the compensating balls either side, which I found very awkward between your legs. And there was a turret either side of me, and the officer standing in this turret. And he said, "All right, driver, go ahead." Well, I came up, and you see, I was so used to a diesel, long stroke engine, a steadier engine. And, of course, I pulled back my sticks just that little bit too soon. And, of course, the engine just cut on me, didn't it?
So you stalled it?
I stalled it. Mm. And I won't tell you what the driver, the officer said, but he called me all the so-and-sos. He said, "Do you realise what you would have done if you'd been this in action?" And I said, "Yes, I realise that." And then I explained to him. I said, "Look, this is the first petrol job I've driven. I've always driven diesels. So he said, "All right, we'll do it again." And, of course, next time I was prepared for it, you see, and I gave it a little more stick, and over I went. And, of course, I passed. But it taught me a lesson, and that taught me a lesson in later driving, when, of course, through different campaigns, different tanks, diesel and petrol, and of course the Wright Cyclone engine in the Grants and Lees. Each engine is a little bit different.
I'm going to ask you about the various the driving characteristics of the various types you've mentioned.
Yes.
And also the method of instruction. Did you get given classroom theory about driving and handling tanks before you went out to actually?
Oh yes, yes. They had classrooms where you had engines which were, if I can just break there, in as much that they gave us instruction on an engine which was they had Rolls Royce engines which were sectionized, and they gave us diesel training. You know, everything from the helical groove right the way through to compression. But it really wasn't of any use. I suppose they thought it was of use, but it wasn't of use because I never drove anything that had a Rolls-Royce engine in it. The first engine, after my basic training, when I went out to the Middle East, was the Wright Cyclone engine. Aero engine, which of course is an entirely different different engine entirely, and apart from the fact that you clean the air filters and you took the governor off if you could, because the fitters did have a tendency to, you had a governor on it, and if you're going from one wadi to another and you know you're out in the open with enemy tanks ranging on you, you want to get from A to B as quickly as possible. And what you don't want is to have your foot flat to the floorboards with the rev counter going up, reaching peak revs, and the governor taken in and cutting back out on you. So we used to very carefully take the governor off, you see. But then if you had any trouble with the engine, of course, the sons of the fitters saw that the governor was disconnected, he'd probably put it back on again. But apart from that, and I say cleaning the air filters, there was nothing else you could do with the aero engine.
What about the earlier types of tanks? You mentioned you drove the Valentine, the Matilda.
Oh yes, yes.
The Lloyd.
The old Lloyd, carrier. Yes.
What were the significant features of each of those types of vehicle that you remember making an impact on your
Valentine?
Car?
Very slow indeed. Matilda again. I felt they were cumbersome. I was very pleased that I never had to drive them in action. Heavily armoured, obviously, the Matilda, but I wouldn't have liked to have. Because, again, the fact that they were undergunned, I mean, you felt that you were just a sitting duck in those. I mean, you were rumbling from one point to another.
What sort of speed could you get out of Matilda?
Oh my gosh. In bad ground, you wouldn't get much more 10 or 12 miles. You were using the box all the time. Valentine was a little bit better. But I wouldn't think you'd get any more than 18 at the most out of them. I wouldn't have thought.
You know, did you remember what they were like to drive from the point of view of ease and
comfort? Oh, yeah,
the
sticks.
Strength
the,
you
the,
had to
yes,
use.
Certainly they were easier to drive than the American tanks. You know, the fact you were assisted.
Does that mean power assisted?
Power assisted, yes. That was a great advantage. With Grants, Lees and Shermans, it was a case, you know, sort of, if especially if they were getting a little bit on the worn side, then it was feet up on the differential and heaving back, you know, to sort of get them around. Yes, I would say the British tanks were easier to drive. I would have thought, and of course you feel also with British tanks, you were sort of, especially with the Crusaders, nice fast tank, but again, very You're very conscious of the fact that you only had a little two-pounder gun up there. I mean, we used to use a two-pounder gun down at Bombington, and I used to think, my goodness, you know, what a silly little thing this is. But I remember them welding on pieces of pipe over the top of the two-pound to make it look as though it was a six-pounder, which was a bit naughty, but still, I suppose it was the effect on the enemy. But if I can just come back to when we arrived at Port Tewfik, we got into the barracks there, and we hadn't been in the barracks more than a day, and I was told to report to the squadron office. I got the squadron office, and I reported to this officer, and he said, "Ah, Court," he said, "you're the man that lost a gun," he said, "in Liverpool, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." And again, they asked me how it was and how I'd lost it. And it fascinated me to think that that had followed me right the way round from Liverpool, and they were on the ball right there at the moment I got off the boat. Obviously, they put a great deal of emphasis on the fact I lost a good pistol, but I thought that was great, the fact they'd follow that up, you know.
Every piece of equipment has to be accounted for.
Yes, yes.
When the other thing I wanted to ask you about driving these various types, the Valentine, Matilda, and so on, was the quality of the view you got as the driver, because I think you mentioned